Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new episode of My Old Kentucky Podcast, a podcast about politics and policy in the state of Kentucky. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me as always is Jasmine Smith. Today on the show, we're going to be talking about Matt Bevin and visit to the Supreme Court. Jasmine is going to talk to us about panhandling, and we are also going to talk about the real ID law in more detail than we did last week, in addition to some quick hits that we have. So, Jasmine, without further ado, are you ready to get started?
Let's go.
Okay, so I guess I will talk first about Matt Bevin and his decision to not appeal a Supreme Court ruling. So, close listeners to the show may remember a couple of weeks ago when I had to do the show all by myself. Jasmine abandoned me.
Sorry, Robert.
It's okay. I talked a little bit about Matt Bevin's first loss at the Supreme Court. To remind you about that case, Matt Bevin had cut a certain amount of money from higher education budgets from the budget prior to when he was elected. If you want to know more about that, you can go back and listen to the old show. It's only 10 minutes long. If you're interested, it's worth it, I promise. So anyways, he lost that case in front of the Supreme Court. And after he lost at the Supreme Court, Governor Bevin had 20 days to ask the Supreme Court to reconsider. So now those 20 days have elapsed, and the governor has decided he will not ask the Supreme Court to reconsider the ruling. This issue about university funding is now over, dead, and done with. I think this is important and worth talking about because it gives us a little bit of a clue as to how Governor Bevin will handle future losses, potential future losses, at the Supreme Court level. So to me, the biggest story about Governor Bevin's administration so far has been his attempt to increase the power of the executive at the expense of other branches of government. And this goes to show you that he, you know, at what level he does respect the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court made a decision. He asked them, he's standing by that ruling. So to me, worth talking about. Jasmine, what do you think?
Well, what I'm wondering is if they make some kind of motion to reconsider, how often does that actually change the ruling?
Probably never. And I guess that gets to a little bit of the fact that, you know, what does this accomplish?
Right.
There was a piece of me that kind of thought that this was round one of Bevin versus Beshear at the Supreme Court, and how much are you willing to fight? Are you going to go beyond the ruling of the Supreme Court and to the final ruling of the Supreme Court? And it seems like he's okay with letting it lie. So it's just nice to have something that's done with, I think.
There's finality to one story that we've discussed,
yes,
maybe.
Yes, absolutely. That's absolutely right. And I think that's something that close watchers may be getting a little bit stressed about, is like, is this ever going to end? Are we going to appeal all these things
and,
all the way up to the Supreme Court?
And I think we're still waiting to find out if he's going to appeal the rulings regarding the board reconstructing and stuff. I don't think we know about that yet.
Right. We don't know if they're going to go to the Supreme Court yet. Is that what you're saying?
Isn't that right? Hasn't he? Franklin Circuit Court ruled in those cases, but we don't know if he's going to appeal that yet.
Right. I guess right. We don't know for sure.
We're guessing.
That he will. Regardless, it's nice to have some finality and to know that it can be done, I guess. Okay. Jasmine, tell us a little bit about panhandling and why that's important to us today.
We are going to talk some constitutional law.
All right.
And a little bit more about the Kentucky Supreme Court. So this past Friday, the Kentucky Supreme Court heard the case of Dennis Champion, who was jailed for violating a panhandling ordinance in Fayette County. So panhandling being begging for money, essentially.
Right.
The maximum penalty for panhandling in Fayette County is 30 days in jail and a $100 fine. In Jefferson County, the maximum is actually a $250 fine. So these are people who are asking for money, and then they can be jailed or have to pay a fine for that.
This isn't just in Lexington. It's in Louisville, and I would assume it's probably some other places,
and
too.
A lot of city government probably have ordinances like this, and we'll kind of get to what's happened to some of those later on.
And we're saying county, but it's worth to mention here too that Fayette County and Jefferson County both are merged with the city government, so
right, so this is a Louisville metro ordinance and a Lexington Fayette urban
county,
government,
not urban county government.
So yeah, so,
L-U-C-G.
Right, so Mr. Champion lost his case in Fayette District Court and the appeal in Fayette Circuit Court, and the Supreme Court decided to hear his case on Friday. Meanwhile, in Jefferson County last Thursday, District Judge Hayner held that Louisville Metro's panhandling ordinance is unconstitutional. And so, what are the arguments on both sides? To prosecutors, this is a public safety issue. This has nothing to do with the speech. It's about standing in the street and walking up to motorists and disrupting the traffic flow. And they say that it's dangerous for both pedestrians and motorists.
So this is like a lot of those people that are kind of on the side of interstates as you get off, and they're in front of the exit sign, and it's like, there's something going on with me, I need your money. Like,
right.
Those people are like walking up in next to cars, which is what they're saying is dangerous.
Right. So they're saying this comes down to safety. It's not about what their sign says. It's not about what they're saying. This is a public safety issue. The defense argument is twofold. First, panhandling is protected by the First Amendment, Mr. Champion's defense attorney argued. And they said that a beggar's message contributes to the interchange of ideas regarding homelessness, and in fact, panhandling serves a public good and could even be considered political speech. So they're saying that the right to hold up a sign, you know, on a public street or sidewalk is protected by the First Amendment.
Right.
Their second argument is that cities have the right to have ordinances that include fines or civil penalties, but it's up to the legislature to decide what is criminal. And an ordinance should not be criminalized or something that carries jail time.
So the state government has to set what is and is not criminal, and cities can essentially decide what the fines and civil penalties for those are? Is that what this is saying?
No, they're saying that a city can have ordinances and they can be civil, so those things can have fines or penalties, but they can't make something a crime.
Ah, okay, I see. So you can't set criminal law at the city level.
Right.
Okay.
So let's discuss those arguments a little bit further. So first, the First Amendment argument. It's the defense's argument that public streets are absolutely public forums, so this type of speech should be subject to strict scrutiny, and that the government must have a compelling interest to regulate content-based speech. The Supreme Court does not like content-based restrictions to speech.
Right.
A content-based restriction is basically a law that outlaws the type of speech. So they don't want to restrict what you say.
Right.
There are also restrictions called time, place, and manner restrictions. And those are a little bit more okay. A time, place, or manner restriction is a restriction on where or what time the speech is happening, but has nothing to do with the content of the speech. And so for a time, place, or manner restriction, those just have to be reasonable. But if it's a restriction banning a certain type of speech or the content, then that's subject to a higher level of scrutiny.
So if I were to say, like, a content-based restriction would be something like, you know, you can't, I would be able to say, like, any of the curse words I want, and I would not, you would not want to restrict that, because that would be, like, a content restriction, right?
Right, or a law that bans some political speeches in a mm-hmm. certain place, or religious speeches in a certain place.
Or you can't protest in front of the law school, or something like that.
Right.
That would be, like, a content speech. Well, ooh, that's a good question. So time, place, or manner.
There are some restrictions that kind of sound like both. And so how can you really tell if it's a content-based restriction or a time, place, manner restriction? And to determine that, you ask, what is the government's primary goal with the law? Is it to keep people from getting the content, so to keep people from hearing a certain message?
Right.
Or is it something like public safety? If the issue is a public safety issue, it's probably more like a time, place, or manner restriction.
Interesting.
And so if speech is happening in a public forum, there has to be a compelling government interest to restrict that speech. And the defense is arguing that public streets are absolutely public forums. The prosecution, on the other hand, is saying, no, an intersection of two streets is not a public forum. This is not a place where people exchange ideas or have political or intellectual discourse. It'd be dangerous if a street was a public forum.
Right. We're not going to record our podcast in the middle of Maine and First or something like that.
Right. Probably not. And so I think that the prosecutor would say that this is just a time, place, or manner restriction because the goal is public safety. But the ordinances specifically restrict begging. And so I think that's kind of a content-based restriction because you're not banning selling Girl Scout cookies or anything else, you're banning begging in that area.
Right. So a Girl Scout could set up a table somewhere in a public street and sell Girl Scout cookies, which is essentially the same deal. It's like asking for money, right?
Right. I think at the Supreme Court, they talked about in oral arguments, a question was raised about street performances. You know, street performances aren't covered by the ordinance. It's only begging. And so this seems kind of like a content-based restriction, which we don't like.
Right, right. So yeah, it wouldn't be time, place, or manner, because they're saying that place is what matters. That's what matters, and that this is not a public forum. It's a public safety issue, but they let other things be there, right?
Right.
So that's what they're saying. Yeah, okay, that makes sense to me.
And so that's the First Amendment argument, and if this is a content-based restriction, then that's subject to strict scrutiny, so the government has to have a really good reason to restrict that kind of speech. The second argument is that there are competing state laws.
Mm.
One law gives local governments the authority to enact ordinances. That's what we were talking about earlier. City governments can enact ordinances that have civil penalties or fines, but then another law says that the General Assembly must approve of crimes that carry jail time. And this is the argument that sold Judge Hayner in Jefferson County. He didn't even address the First Amendment argument, but he cited the law that prohibits local governments from criminalizing offenses and stated that this is an exclusive power of the legislature and that allowing Louisville Metro government to do this is basically allowing them to rewrite the Kentucky Penal Code. And in his ruling, he stated that he cited a case that says that the legislature is presumed to know about a law when they pass a subsequent law. And so they're presumed to have known about the law that allowed local governments to pass ordinances, and the law allowing the legislature to decide what's criminal makes it clear that they didn't intend for local governments to be able to decide that.
Okay.
So he's looking at those two laws and saying, you know, they knew about this one. This law allowing them to enact ordinances doesn't give them the power to decide what's criminal and what should carry jail time.
So in Louisville, you said earlier that there's a $250 fine.
Yes.
Does that also...
That's the maximum. 30 days of jail time.
Okay.
And or a maximum $250 fine.
So if it had just been the fine, it might have been different. But because it carried jail time, or does the fine not matter?
I think it depends on exactly what the ordinance said, whether it makes it a misdemeanor or a violation, whether it's a crime or not. I think if it carries jail time, it certainly is. They don't always enforce jail time, you know, more often or not. It's just maybe a fine. I think that Mr. Champion, who is the one in Lexington who is challenging the ordinance at the Supreme Court, I think he ended up serving 3 days,
okay,
maybe.
And that's kind of the crux of the issue. Okay.
Right. Judge Hayner struck down the Louisville Metro ordinance, but right now that is only binding in his division of district court.
Right.
So until the Supreme Court rules, that's not binding in any other court.
So this went before the Supreme Court, and we're a little bit waiting their decision.
Right. Similar ordinances in other states and cities have recently been struck down as unconstitutional. I think maybe that's where this is headed.
So there's some other precedents from other states that says that this has been struck down.
Yes.
And so we're awaiting what our Supreme Court has to say.
And I believe that they have struck those ordinances down based on the First Amendment arguments.
Gotcha. Well, we'll see what they do here. All right, Jasmine, I'm going to tell you about Real ID. You excited about Real ID? It's a big, important issue.
It's pretty important, actually.
It is kind of important. Okay, so we talked a little bit about this as a quick hit last week because there was a little bit of news that we talked about, and I kind of glossed over it a little bit, so I wanted to get a little bit more in-depth this week to talk about Real ID. So a little bit of history. 9/11 happened. Hopefully you remember that. That was a big deal. In 2004, there was a commission that released a report, the 9/11 commission report. This was a really big deal back when it happened. It was a red, white, and blue book. They sold it at Barnes & Noble because it was 2004. And there were a lot of recommendations in the book that the commission said that the federal government should do to make things more secure, essentially. And one of the big recommendations in that was the Real ID. So they said they wanted a more secure identification system that was constitutional, but had a little bit more scrutiny and security around how those IDs were issued and had some more security around what was in those IDs. So in the federal government in 2005, the Real ID Act was passed. The idea that, you know, this they would centralize some of the processing and have some standards around what was included in a driver's license and things. And the, most of this was around driver's licenses. Completely redoing the way that states did driver's licenses is obviously very expensive. So in addition to requiring this, the federal government gave a significant amount of money to states to offset the costs for implementing the, these processes. I don't know what the original deadline, this is again was passed in 2005, I don't know what the original deadline was, but it was almost immediately re-extended to 2011. So between 2005 and 2011, states were supposed to get in compliance with the Real ID Act. 2011 was about to come. There were a lot of states that weren't in compliance. They re-extended the deadline to 2013. 2013 came. The 2013 deadline lapsed, and there were a lot of states that were not in compliance, and all the states that were not in compliance were given an extra 6 months at least to get into compliance. So Kentucky was one of those states that was not yet in compliance. Kentucky got their extension after 2013 deadline, and then in October 15, when Kentucky's extension expired, they asked for an extra extension and were granted an extra extension of 1 year. So 2015, we got an extra 1 year extension. So everybody's like, oh my gosh, this is actually finally happening. I can't believe it. It's more than a decade later. So 2015 legislative session happened. That was last year, Governor Bevin's first legislative session as the governor. The House and the Senate both passed a law to get into compliance with the Real ID Act. And Governor Bevin originally stated on his Facebook that he was in favor of this. He was like, you know, this makes a lot of sense. There's a lot in here that makes a lot of sense. We should do this. But April 28th, after both houses, the House and Senate adjourned their business for the legislative session, Governor Bevin vetoed the Real ID law. There was a couple of other things he vetoed as well, but the Real ID was one of the things he vetoed. So this is what his signing statement said, or his veto statement said. Since that time, however, it has become increasingly clear that there is tremendous opposition and misunderstanding about this bill. The widespread opposition comes from citizens of Kentucky across the entire political spectrum for a variety of different reasons. Good governance demands the courtesy of time needed to better understand and discuss the difference between Real ID as originally envisioned by its authors and the minimal and voluntary requirements authorized by Senate Bill 245. By taking additional time to study alternative options for the traveling public and having an additional year to continue the dialogue and clear up any remaining misinformation, Kentucky will be better positioned to enact any updates to our driver's licensing system that may ultimately be needed.
What is the tremendous opposition and misunderstanding?
Here's the issue. We had Senate Bill 245, which was to get in compliance with Real ID.
Right.
But it did also take up some other stuff that wasn't necessarily to get in compliance with Real ID, just to streamline the driver's licensing process. There must have been some opposition to. Now, Real ID has always been pretty controversial because there are some privacy advocates who say that this should not be centralized. And the less centralized the issuing of government IDs is, the better off we all are, because they don't necessarily think it's in everybody's best interest for there to be a centralized database of all the United States citizens. We don't need a national ID card. The federal government doesn't need to always know who you are, et cetera, et cetera. Are you familiar with these types of arguments?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's what a big piece of the opposition comes from.
Are there other states who are still not in compliance? Are we one of the only ones left?
We are not the only ones left, but I believe we are the one of the first, so we'll get to this. There are lots of states that are not in compliance. But, as we said, Kentucky got an extension in October of 2015. The legislative session came and went. We passed a law, but it was vetoed. Now it's
so our extension runs out.
Ran out last week.
Okay.
So we filed for a new extension. Obviously, that was something Governor Bevin wanted to do. He said we wanted to get an extra year to talk about this. Okay, I also want to talk for a little bit about how we talked about how we need some more time to discuss Real ID. And whatever you feel about it, if you feel like it's a good idea or a bad idea, at this point, geez, make a decision. It's been a decade. Like, you need to either say we're going to get in compliance, or, you know, we are making a stand to not get in compliance or something. I'm not really quite sure. But it's saying we need more time is a little ridiculous,
right.
A decade down the road.
And not being in compliance could have some weird consequences, right?
We are going to get into that. So we are still thinking about getting into compliance a decade later, and we still haven't quite made up our mind as to what we want to do. So the extension expired in October 2016. On October 12th, the federal government told us, no, we are not giving you a new extension. We are going to begin enforcing the penalties associated with the Real ID Act. So now that Kentucky's officially out of compliance, there's no extension granted, there are four phases of enforcement that will begin to occur. So I'll go over these four phases. The first one is restricted areas. So very restricted areas in the DHS, the Department of Homeland Security's Nebraska Avenue complex in Washington, is no longer accessible. So if you want to go there on your trip to Washington, you have to take your passport if you have a Kentucky driver's license. Okay, phase two, restricted areas for all federal facilities and nuclear power plants. We used to have a nuclear power plant in Paducah. I don't think it's operational anymore. I don't know if that's going to be that much of a big deal. But if you want to go into federal facilities in Washington, this is a little bit down the road, but that would become a problem for you if you only have your Kentucky driver's license. Phase three, semi-restricted areas. So these would be areas available to the general public but subject to ID-based access control. So here's a good example of that. I was invited, along with my dad, to Camp David. It was kind of cool last year.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was where the president would have got to go. The general public is allowed to go there if they're invited, but they have to have very specific ID stuff. This ID, my Kentucky driver's license, would not be allowed to do that for this federal facility. That's a good example of that one. So phase four, though, and this is the big one, boarding federally regulated commercial aircraft. So if you want to go on an airplane in the United States, your Kentucky ID will no longer work. Obviously, phase four is the biggest and most intense one. That will not be enforced until 2018. So we are going. This process has started. It takes a long time for all of it to kick in. The penalties become more and more as time goes along, but Kentucky has to decide what they're going to do. This process has been kicked off, and we are really starting to see some actual penalties occurring.
2018 isn't really that far away if you consider that our bill hasn't even passed.
We
haven't really taken any steps.
We've already had the 2016 legislative session. This could feasibly be passed in 2017, which is the next legislative session, but then the 2018 legislative session, I believe, I don't think it will be until October 2018, but I'm actually not totally sure about that. So
if it's January 1st, we really have about a year.
We have one legislative session to fix this, unless they call us in a special session for this specific problem, which has a lot of costs associated with it, and it wouldn't be great. So yeah, so this is a big deal.
I've heard attorneys already talking about this affecting the ability to practice in federal court.
Sure.
I guess that would
courthouses
fall under phase
would be,
three.
Mm-hmm. Courthouses would absolutely be one of these things that would be a big deal. So, you know, just to be safe, if you're out there and you don't have a passport, and you, even if you're not planning to go out of the country, it may be worth your while to get one.
I guess you should get a passport.
Yeah, absolutely. Any questions about Real ID, or do we cover it pretty well, Jazz?
I think that's good.
All right, excellent. Okay, Jasmine, are you ready for some quick hits?
I'm ready.
Okay, so I wanted to bring this up. There's a really, really great Courier Journal story Deborah Yetter did with Derek Guy, who is a transgender man who works for the Cabinet for Family Services as a social worker. Derek began his transition after his start date with the Cabinet. He started with the Cabinet, then he began his transition to a man. And there's been a couple of things that happened, but Mr. Guy has filed a grievance with the Cabinet. Ms. Yetter, Deborah Yetter, the lady who wrote the story, she has a written story and a video with Mr. Guy on the Courier Journal website. This, I think, is a really important issue in Kentucky and will be an increasing issue if the Republican Party takes the House of Representatives.
Definitely.
Yeah, so if you're familiar with HB2 in North Carolina, which restricted bathroom usage in public places and stuff, that will probably begin to be types of stuff that is taken up by the Kentucky legislature if the Republicans take the House of Representatives. So big stuff, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, and the second thing I wanted to talk about was Jim Beam workers went on strike this week. And it's one of the most unique strikes I've ever seen in my entire life. The strike is unique because it's not about salary or pay rates or anything that you normally would hear a strike be about. The strike is actually about workload. So in the bourbon industry, I guess, work is largely seasonal. I'm not quite sure all of the things. I've done some of the distillery tours. Have you ever done a distillery tour?
I've done the Woodford Reserve tour before.
That one's the best one that I've been on. So I don't know. However this works, it's seasonal work. There's more at certain times of the year. And Jim Beam apparently has been heavily reliant on temporary workers when stuff gets busy, and they've really, in the opinion of the union membership, overly taxed their full-time employees. So they have gone on strike because the company decided not to hire more full-time workers, which is kind of funny. We have a strike now because there's not enough people being hired. Typically, unions are like, I want to protect my job. I don't want more people coming in. The UFCW 111D, that's the union. They're asking the company to do away with its two-tiered system. So Jim Beam, which is owned by Beam Sundry, which is a Japanese company, they decided they didn't want to do that. They offered them a contract, which was rejected widely by the union membership. And so the company Beam Sundry hasn't openly admitted, but it does appear that they're going to hire replacement workers to continue operations. So if you are a bourbon or whiskey drinker, keep that in mind when you're at the store, depending on how you feel about labor issues. So one last thing, Jasmine. One more quick hit.
What's that?
Okay, so this literally just came across my feed earlier today, but the state legislatures from both parties, who are a member of a certain cabinet in the legislature, they have asked Mike Harmon to audit the finances of the Yum Center. So this will probably be a big deal. There's a lot of stuff that the Yum Center does that is kind of weird, and like a lot of financial stuff that people have been worried about for years. The auditor getting in there and looking at that could turn up some real interesting stuff, I think. I don't know. All right, Jasmine, anything about the quick hits that you think we should talk more about?
Nope, I didn't even know that was a quick hit, so...
We just added it.
I know.
It just happened.
It was that quick.
It was so fast. All right, well, Jasmine, where can people find out about us?
They can find out about us on Facebook. We have a page that you can like, My Old Kentucky Podcast. You can listen to our podcast on your various podcasting applications. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, some others. What others are we on, Robert?
I mean, I don't know.
All of them?
Yeah, those are the two that I know about, but I know that there's other ones, and okay. I know you can subscribe to us on them.
We also post our show notes on Medium, and you can follow us on Twitter, at MyOldKYPod.
All right. Well, thanks, Jasmine.
Thank you, Robert.
You're welcome. All right. Until next week. Thanks, everybody. Make music all the day.